Stafford White designed some of the most notable buildings in New York City and throughout New England during the United States' Golden Age, or Gilded Age, and quite a few survive till this day. Joining me now are Stafford White's great-grandson, Samuel G. White, his wife Elizabeth as well. Together they have written Stafford White Architect, which is published by Rizzoli. Welcome to the show, or in your case, Sam, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
You're also an architect, aren't you, Sam?
I am, Leonard.
Did they teach you your grandfather in architecture school?
No, in architecture school, I don't think my grandfather was part of the curriculum.
That's weird because he is considered one of the greatest architects that America's ever produced.
Well, at the time that I went to architecture school, the architects that were interesting were Robert Venturi and Lou Kahn. And I think you have a lot to learn from those, or one has.
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been many books in Stafford White and his famous architectural firm, McKim, Mead & White. What did you hope to accomplish with this book, Elizabeth?
Well, I think our main goal was a visual presentation to take the buildings that are extant and commission some new color photography. I think we were amazingly fortunate to work with John Wallen, who has worked with us before on our previous books. And then, of course, we did treat the major buildings that are no longer extant, Madison Square Garden and Madison Square Presbyterian Church.
And the Herald Building.
And the Herald Building through the archives at the Museum of the City of New York and the Historical Society.
Well, the original Madison Square Garden is now occupied by a rather undistinguished building, and you have to wonder what happens. Why do great buildings get knocked down?
Well, in the case of Madison Square Garden, it's occupied by a building designed by Cass Gilbert, who was in fact a protege of Stafford White's.
Oh, maybe I'm thinking of another building.
It's not a great building, but that building,
because Cass Gilbert did do the Woolworth Building, yes. And that is one of the great buildings of New York.
That building found itself in a position of being worth less than the land that it was on. It was from a financial point of view, it was a money loser from the beginning. I think it never made more than about $2,000 a night, and that just couldn't even pay off the interest on the construction loan, let alone any dividends on the stock. And it was a wonderful building, but it was, and I think that that's probably true for, if you were to look at Madison Square Garden today, it only survives because of tax breaks or some other television support, and the original Madison Square Garden just didn't have that kind of support.
What are the most significant Stafford White buildings still around in New York?
Well, I think certainly the Washington Arch at Washington Square. There are a number of club buildings, the Metropolitan Club at 60th and 5th. Up in the Bronx, there is the Gould Library, which was formerly the Library of NYU, now part of Bronx Community College. And then there's also Stafford White's very last work out in Brooklyn in Fort Greene Park, the Prisoner Ship Monument. And that actually has been restored and is being rededicated on Saturday.
One of my favorite White buildings in Midtown is the Villard Houses. But what do you think of the way that it has been attached to the Helmsley Palace?
I'm pausing because I'm sure this is a family radio show, and there was some pretty unfavorable descriptions of the literal attachment of the palace to that building. But
in the book, you have a picture of it before the attachment, and it looks just grand. And now it's a very strange marriage. I always wonder why an architect would design, if they're going to put a building attached to it, why they wouldn't design something that had at least something in common with one of the great buildings of New York.
I'm not sure that building was the Helmsley Palace was designed by an architect, actually. So. it would be really terrific to get a chance to do that again, but that's going to be hard.
That building is symmetrical, and a lot of the buildings are symmetrical. Was that part of the Stafford White approach?
Generally, but not exclusively. I think that if you look at Rosecliff in Newport, it is an asymmetrical building. The entrance is way off to one side, and that's related to White's interest in sort of processional movement through his buildings, and so it's quite unusual to have put the entrance to one side. In fact, I would say it's typical of Renaissance architecture and post-Renaissance architecture that the entrance is dead center.
In fact, he was really influenced by the Renaissance, wasn't he? Also in the way that he collaborated with artists.
Yes. That he learned from Richardson. His six-year apprenticeship with Richardson taught him that an architect was the leader of a team of artists and that the collaboration was important. And I think that's something that's actually been lost today. You see little or none of that. And that's a shame.
Now what happens often is a building is made and then the owner of the building goes out and gets a big painting or a sculpture from a famous artist of the moment.
Yeah, it was the sort of the standard used to be the IMP library with the Henry Moore sort of sitting in front of it. And it wasn't so much of a collaboration as a handsome composition.
For a long time it was a Calder mobile in the lobby, wasn't it?
Yes.
Now it's a Frank Stella.
That's true. But now also I think the Percent for Art programs have involved artists sooner in those kinds of situations, and that there is some collaboration going on.
So what kinds of artists did he work with?
Well, starting with Augusta St. Gaudens, his friend from his youth, practically, and then actually started working with Frederick McMonnies.
Right, and then Thomas Dewing, the painter, did a number of murals for him.
So did he design the rooms that these pieces were in with the murals or the sculpture in mind?
He must have, but one would like to have been a fly on that wall just to have heard the thing develop. He would identify the artist and talk about the project, and then you just don't know how the sketches went back and forth after that.
There was an interesting letter from him to McMonnies. McMonnies did the sculptural program on the Washington Arch, and there was a letter from White saying, well, I've seen your sketches, and they seem, essentially too frivolous to me. I was looking for something much more severe and classical. But he'd written in just a marvelous, you know, if you don't agree with me, you know, let's talk about it kind of a way. So he did work closely, and there's certainly a lot of correspondence between him and St. Gaudens for the Farragut, for example, in Madison Square Park.
Well, it seems like whenever there was a major public project, they called Stanford White because there were others. He did the entrance to the Manhattan Bridge, didn't he?
That was Carrere and Hastings, I think, who did those entrances. He did entrances to
Prospect Park,
yes, and which have. I mean, I always have mixed feelings about the arch at Prospect Park. I understand that they did some work.
The Grand Army Plaza.
At Grand Army Plaza. That was Duncan who was the architect. And that piece of public sculpture always reminds me of what they say Frank Lloyd Wright said about Grant's tomb, which was that there was not a single thing you could do to it that would not improve it.
Well, it does have some Thomas Aiken's reliefs, and that's, I think, pretty all right with me. But that's another matter. Still, Stanford White was to New York what David Burnham was to Chicago. He was the guy you called upon if something important had to be done.
Yes, I think with the completion and success of Madison Square Garden, I think he became the go-to architect in New York City.
My guests are Samuel and Elizabeth White, and they have put together what has to be one of the handsomest books of recent memory called Stanford White, Architect. It's from Rizzoli. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You start off with a chapter on his own two houses, and one in Long Island, one in Manhattan, neither of which were built originally by him.
That's correct. The one on Long Island was a sort of a vernacular mid-19th century farmer's cottage, which he rented and then eventually bought. And then as his self-esteem or fortune or whatever started expanding, he just kept expanding the house.
And the collection that he put inside the house.
Yes. Although I think the great pieces were really in the New York house, and there the problem was that Stanford White had a pretty good income as a successful architect, but he did not personally have the kind of wealth that he needed to buy a house, so he had to rent the house on Gramercy Park.
Even at the end, even when he was the big star?
Well, if you read Paul Baker's book, you discover that at the end when he was a big star was when he was in the biggest trouble financially. And so he was a bit of a shell game.
By the way, if people want to have a sense of what we're talking about, we have a slideshow of some of the pictures from this book on our show page at WNYC.org. He did design buildings for pretty much all the richest people in New York. He did the Payne Whitney House. He did the Astor House, the Vanderbilt House, didn't he?
Well, it's because he was the best. I mean, he designed extremely beautiful houses. And the thing is that beauty at that level does cost some money. You go and get the most beautiful paintings or the most beautiful tapestries or furniture, and in combined with the level of craftsmanship that he was going to be looking for in these houses, that was going to require a pretty significant investment.
And he was responsible for the furniture, the paintings, the window treatments, as well as the building itself. That's something that's been lost in architecture, hasn't it?
Yes. He sometimes was commissioned to go on buying trips to Europe. Sometimes the client went along. Sometimes he went on his own. There is some correspondence of outrage at what he was spending. And Sam always likes to think that people get over that once they see things installed. And I imagine Stanford White was hopeful that that was the case, too.
It's an architect's wish.
He did some churches as well, although it's my sense he wasn't a particularly religious man.
No, but I think he had a quite good understanding of the relationship between the style of a church and the congregation for which he was designing it. And so he believed, for example, that Gothic architecture really was reserved for buildings for the Roman Catholic faith, and that for the Protestant churches in America, he looked more towards the early Christian churches.
Do we see his influence on other architects of the time? Did his grand houses then wind up being adapted for the more modest houses on Main Street throughout the New England, the Atlantic coast?
I think that his designs in what I would call a federal revival style did have a significant influence on the next generation of architects.
And you're talking about the townhouses?
The townhouses, the brick ones. Yeah.
His work changed over the years, didn't it? Do you see him moving toward modern architecture, or is it his love of detail always going to keep him back in a Renaissance Palladio influence?
It's a really good question. As he got older, I think he got more interested in restraint, and he, for example, the Prison Ship Martyrs Monument has no detail on it whatsoever, and it's an extraordinarily powerful and moving image. Would he have been able to make that sort of leap over to abstraction? I doubt it, but in that sense, the timing at the end of his career was fortuitous.
He was also very interested in technical things. I mean, he had a collection of cars, and he was fascinated by the electricity at the World's Columbian Exposition. There's a letter that he stayed up three nights running, taking advantage of that.
He was in the gossip columns a lot during his lifetime. I can't imagine many other architects who would have been covered by the newspapers as much as he was.
Well, it's a marketing program of sorts, I suppose.
But then, of course, the circumstances of his death. Do you think that the fact that he was killed, shot to death by Harry Thought, a jealous husband, on the steps of the... He was coming down from his apartment in the Madison Square Garden, wasn't
he? On the roof of Madison Square Garden at that rooftop cafe.
And he was, in the end, that wound up being called the trial of the century, although the many other trials of the century followed. But do you think that's muddied his reputation to some degree?
Yes, and I, in terms of your original question to Elizabeth, what we were trying to accomplish, I think we were really trying to bring the focus back to what he accomplished rather than the manner in which he was killed and the subsequent publicity of the trial, that it's very, very hard to tell the story without getting into that. And we thought that that in a book we could control the story a bit and we could really keep the focus right on the work.
Although an interesting aspect of this life is that it involves art and celebrity. And that's something that we usually think of as being a lot more contemporary.
It's true. I mean, and celebrity was an essential part of it. I mean, he said that he would, he wrote a letter to a friend saying, I work all day and then I have to dress up and do the society thing every night. And that was what he was doing. It was, the society thing was very important to his practice.
I assume that being an architect named Samuel White, people do make the connection.
Well, I hope they can modify their expectations in every respect. My practice is quite different from his, I'd say.
Elizabeth, do you have a favorite Stanford White building in New York City?
I don't have an absolute favorite, but right now we are living close to three. We're living at 9th and 5th, so we have the Church of the Ascension where he did the interior, and we have the Washington Arch, and we have the Judson Church. And so we're just kind of surrounded by it. I used to work in the Cable Building at Broadway and Houston, and that was really a remarkable experience. The interior is all chopped up now, but you can still get the sense of the wonderful light coming in through the big windows, and it's a wonderful plan around two light wells, and it just has been very interesting to be in that space.
A lot of his buildings by his contemporaries have been knocked out, and you think that the reason so many of his buildings have been saved, of course, now you can't knock them down. You can't even modify them, as Le Cirque, the restaurant, discovered when they try to redecorate the inside of the Villard houses.
Well, those are the ones in New York City that are protected. There are some that are outside of New York City that aren't protected yet. There's a quite wonderful house in Cornwall, Pennsylvania, which is near Harrisburg, which almost fell down. I mean, it had been inaccessible for 40 years because it was a country club for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, and then they walked away from it and locked the door, and it almost sort of fell to vandals until it was saved about 5 years ago. They are, the ones in New York City at this point are generally well protected.
Well, I think people who don't even know about architecture will look at a Stanford White building in the same way that they might look at the Seagram building, Mies van der Rohe's building, and recognize that there's something special about them, that there are other buildings that are like them, but they're not as good.
I would hope so. I think they are, and they are special. I have this theory that you have more fun at a party in a room designed by Stanford White, and I think that you actually have more fun walking down the street looking at a building designed by Stanford White as well.
And why do you think that is? Did he just understand proportions
well? These buildings have what I call a kind of a quality of empathy. They engage you, and they start to set up almost a dialogue in which you are able to project an interpretation or a sort of an understanding of the building onto the building, that they are not static in terms of their meaning.
So why don't more architects think in those terms?
You're not taught that. I mean, it's just that's something that you either know or you don't know.
You're nodding your head, Elizabeth.
No, I think it's absolutely true. And these buildings, you walk past them and you do notice them, and you do feel better for seeing them.
And I've been at parties in some of these rooms. And
did you have a better time?
Well, what happens more often than not is you just know that you're in some special place. In fact, I'm likely to ask, is this a Stanford White building? Because there's just something about the proportions, the way the whole thing is later. They seem to be as close to perfect as you can imagine. And even if they have a lot of decoration, they never feel over-decorated.
No, he really was able to keep control of it. But they do give, they add something to the experience of being in the room. The main ballroom at Rosecliff in Newport is now, you can rent it and you can give a dinner party or a dance there, and it's fabulous. It just, instead of this being a sort of a static museum space where you're not allowed to walk on the floor or bring in a glass of water, you can actually have a dinner there.
It also seems to me that these buildings have been respected by the people who owned them afterward. Frank Lloyd Wright wasn't always so lucky. My thanks to my guests, Samuel G. White and Elizabeth White. Their book, Stanford White Architect, is published by Rizzoli. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.